Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. And on the show today, we talk about our first book club selection of the year. And the book's titled, How the Word is Passed, Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. And the author is Clint Smith. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, author of an award-winning poetry collection titled Counting Descent, and has written a thought-provoking book for us to read and talk about. And I'm hoping you had a chance to read the book. Did it change your view of our country's history of slavery? If you didn't read the book, I still hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Ideas@wpr.org. Clint Smith, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
It's good to be here with you, Larry.
I really enjoyed your reading your book, and I kept thinking, oh my goodness, I didn't know that. Why didn't I learn that? There, a lot of that goes through it. We can talk some more about that as we go along. But it was our, as a professor on campus at the UW, I was glad to see it was chosen as our 2022's Go Big Read book. That meant that many thousands of students here on this campus read the book, and like in our department, as someone who teaches a class in, has taught a class in broadcasting and podcasting, students would read the book and then prepare a podcast relating to the book. And so that's how, and others obviously had other types of ways of bringing that through. But what was that experience like for you to be have a Go Big Read selection?
Oh, it was amazing. It was amazing. I think about my time with you all on that campus all the time. It was remarkable. Any time that a school, you know, calls you and says, we want to buy, you know, 12,000 of your book, it's a good day. So I feel enormous gratitude. And you know, from what I was very lucky to have How the Word is Passed selected as a common read or freshman read at several different schools this past fall. But the Go Big Read program at University of Wisconsin-Madison is pretty singular in its scale and its scope, in the way that it brings the community together, right? It's not just something that freshmen are meant to read. It's not just something that students are meant to read. It is, you know, one of the coordinators told me that the book was taught in over 160 different classes across the university, in libraries, book clubs. I mean, it's extraordinary. I always tell people that, you know, there's so many remarkable books that never reach the audience that they deserve. So many books that, you know, writers spend years working on these books, and you have nothing is guaranteed about whether or not it will reach a wide audience or whether it won't. So I'm just sort of awash in gratitude that a place like University of Wisconsin would so thoughtfully integrate it into the curriculum and integrate it into the sort of public discourse around the community. It's been amazing.
Yeah, it has been. For those who haven't read the book, maybe How the Word is Passed, maybe you can give us a sort of a bare bones description of the book for everybody.
Yeah, certainly. So this project began in 2017 when I watched several Confederate statues come down in my hometown in New Orleans, statues of P.G.T. Beauregard, Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, these leaders of the Confederacy. And as I was watching these statues come down, I was thinking about what it meant that I grew up in a majority black city in which there were more homages to enslavers than there were to enslaved people. And what are the implications of that? What does it mean that to get to school, I had to go down Robert E. Lee Boulevard? To get to the grocery store, I had to go down Jefferson Davis Parkway? That my middle school was named after a leader of the Confederacy? That my parents still live on a street today named after someone who owned over 150 enslaved people? Because the thing is, you know, that symbols and names and iconography aren't just symbols. They're reflective of the stories that people tell. And those stories shape the narratives that communities carry. And those narratives shape public policy. And public policy shapes the material conditions of people's lives, which isn't to say that if you just take down a 60-foot tall statue of Robert E. Lee, you suddenly erase the racial wealth gap. Mm-hmm. But it does help us recognize what I think about as the sort of ecosystem of ideas and stories and narratives that help ground our collective understanding of American history, our collective understanding of our local histories, and as a result, help more deeply ground us in an understanding of the ways that certain communities and certain demographics of people have been disproportionately or intentionally harmed throughout that history. And so I was thinking about this in the context of New Orleans, and I was looking around, and I was like, well, what are the people, to the places that are doing a good job of telling the story about slavery honestly, and what are the places that aren't? Because I, you know, New Orleans was at one point the largest, busiest slave market in the country.
Yeah.
It was the center of the domestic slave trade. And I realized that I didn't understand the history of slavery in any way that was commensurate with the impact and legacy that it had on my city, on my state, on my country, on me as a descendant of enslaved people. And so I really, so many of my projects are born out of a desire to more fully understand a subject myself, right? I don't begin any project as an expert in that space, certainly not a book project. What's exciting for me about book projects is that I begin wanting to understand and learn, and hopefully the book is an attempt to bring the reader on the sort of narrative and intellectual journey alongside me. And so I decided to visit different historical sites across the country to try to understand how these different places reckon with or fail to reckon with, confronted or failed to confront their relationship to the history of slavery. It brought me to Monticello Plantation in Virginia, to the Blandford Cemetery, one of the largest Confederate cemeteries in the country, to Angola Prison, a prison that was built on a former former plantation, to New York City, to Galveston, Texas, all over the country, just to try to get a sense of how these places tell the story of themselves and what sort of honesty and sort of self-reflection and interrogation exist in these places, which are often on the front lines of cultivating our collective public memory.
Yeah. You know, I want to talk with you about each of those places. Eugene in Viola has just a comment that may work here. Let's go to Eugene. Hi, Eugene. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Larry. There was a Cherokee and a black community that settled up above Lafarge about 1850. Well, my grandmother married into that community by a second marriage about 1920. My mother was raised up there from the time she was about 10 years old, pretty much. And she said it was a good time to grow up, and she said they were good farmers, and they had electricity, running water, and machinery before a lot of the white farmers around there did. But my mother also told me that when they got married, they could not get a marriage license in Vernon County. They wouldn't issue a mixed license.
Yeah. Well, Clint, maybe comment on that. Thanks to Eugene for calling.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that it speaks to, there are so many personal histories and family histories like that. That are often sort of hidden in plain sight. I mean, I think one of the things about this book that I'm most grateful for is that it got me to interview my grandparents. And so the epilogue is a sort of conversation with my grandparents. I went with my maternal grandmother, my paternal grandmother, who was born in 1939, Jim Crow, Florida, and my maternal grandfather, who was born in 1930, Jim Crow, Mississippi. And we went to the National Museum of African American History and Culture together. And I was pushing my grandfather in his wheelchair, his cane laid across his lap. My grandmother was walking a few feet ahead of us, and we were all sort of quiet. It's a somber, solemn place, much of it. And we were walking around, and I realized as I was pushing my grandfather in this wheelchair that so much of the history that is documented in this museum, so much of the violence that's documented in this museum on the National Mall are things that my grandparents experienced firsthand. And it similarly, you know, when I talked to my grandmother afterwards about our experience at the National African American Museum, she said, she kept repeating this refrain, and she was like, I lived it. I lived it. And I think about how, you know, my grandfather's grandfather is someone who was born into slavery. So when my 5-year-old son sits on my grandfather's lap, I imagine my grandfather sitting on his grandfather's lap. And I'm reminded that this history we tell ourselves was a long time ago, simply wasn't that long ago at all. The woman who opened the National Museum of African American History and Culture, a woman named Ruth Bonner, she was the daughter of an enslaved person. This is in 2016, right? Like a person who opened the National Museum of African American History and Culture in 2016 was the daughter of a man who was born into slavery. And so slavery is this thing that we talk about as if it happened in like the Jurassic period, like it was the dinosaurs, the Flintstones, and slavery all existing at the same time. But my grandparents are a reminder to me that we are still so proximate to that history, that there are people alive today who knew, who loved, who were raised by people who were born into intergenerational chattel slavery. And so, you know, what this comment just makes me think about is our proximity to a history that we are often made to think was a long, long time ago, right? This person couldn't marry that person. This person couldn't get on that bus. This person couldn't go to this school. We see it in, you know, black and white documentaries. We read about it in textbooks. Mm-hmm. But I think we can forget that many of the people who experienced that firsthand are the people who are right next to us.
Yeah. And you talk about racism in the book, obviously, and you say it's simply not a matter of bigoted individuals, but rather a systematic issue that gets perpetrated by institutions, schools, historical societies, and many more.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where you have to hold a recognition of both the interpersonal manifestations of racism alongside the structural manifestations of racism. I think sometimes, I was just having this conversation with a friend the other night, I think in the last 10 years or so, as a result of the Black Lives Matter movement, I think there has necessarily been an increasing focus on the structural and systemic manifestations of racism, understanding that racism is not just somebody using a racial slur. It is not just somebody burning a cross on your front yard. It's not just somebody wearing a white hood. It is how, you know, there are stories, there's so many stories that have popped up recently of housing appraisals, right? When, you know, you'll have a black family who will have their home appraised. When the black family is home and when there's black art and black family photos, and, you know, it'll be appraised for $500,000. And then they take all the black art down. They have a white friend come and show the home to the appraiser, the same appraiser as if it were, or an appraiser from the same company, as if it were their home. And the house will be appraised for $800,000-$900,000, right? And so that's just one example of all of the ways that systemic racism, unconscious bias, however one wants to refer to it, continues to literally strip wealth and money away from black people. And that has reverberating outcomes across every facet of your lives. If you are it is stealing hundreds of thousands of dollars from people, right? And that's money that people use to feed their families. That's money people use to send their children to school. That's money people use to decide whether or not they go on vacation. And I mean, so small things like that. And that is one example of endless, innumerable examples are the ways that systemic racism, right, in the sense that it is not an interpersonal action, are incredibly harmful to the people on the receiving end of them. With that said, I don't think that we should, sometimes we can forget that interpersonal racism still exists. I mean, I wrote a piece for The Atlantic a few months ago about how I was getting off of a flight in Charlotte, North Carolina, and there were two women who got in an argument, a white woman and a black woman, and the white woman turned around and used the N-word, with a venom that I hadn't heard in a long time toward the black woman, and then rushed away as people began to look over and realize what happened. And so I remember the feeling in my body as I heard that. I remember the the way that my body reacted to that incident. And it is those compounding interpersonal and systemic experiences that are materially, spiritually, and physically harmful to Black people over the course of decades of their lives.
Clint Smith, our guest today, he is the author of How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. Invite you to join in as well. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, email address, ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Jill Nadeau is our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network. Today we're talking about a book, a powerful book. It's titled How the Word is Passed. The author is Clint Smith, our guest today. It's our Book of the Month Club selection. And great to have him with us. Comments or questions, join in at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@WPR.org. I want to talk with you about the places that you visited. And you started with a visit to, or at least in the book, I'm not sure how the ordering of how you did things, but open the book with your visit to Thomas Jefferson's home in Monticello. Why did you start there and kind of what were your expectations?
Yeah, I went to Monticello because I think Jefferson in so many ways is a microcosm of the story of America, which is to say that America is a place that has provided unparalleled, unimaginable opportunities for millions of people across generations in ways that their own ancestors could have never imagined. And it has also done so at the direct expense of millions and millions of other people who have been intergenerationally subjugated and oppressed. And both of those things are the story of America. It's not one over here and one over there. It's that they're both deeply entangled in one another. And I think Jefferson, as I said, is a sort of personification of that cognitive dissonance in the sense that he is someone who wrote one of the most important documents in the history of the Western world and also enslaved over 600 people over the course of his lifetime, including four of his own children that he had by an enslaved woman named Sally Hemings. He wrote in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal. And he wrote in Notes on the State of Virginia that Black people were likely inferior to whites in both endowments of body and mind. As he put it, said the slave was incapable of love in the same way his white counterpart was. The slave was incapable of possessing or sustaining complex emotion. And so it's the version of Jefferson that I had been taught as a kid growing up did not address the sort of moral and ethical complexity of his life and the moral inconsistency of his stances, right? Jefferson is someone who continued to own enslaved people and yet wrote extensively about how wrong it was, right? It was, it is an example of a man knowing that what he is doing is wrong and yet continuing to do it anyway because of the opportunities and privileges and wealth and lifestyle that it affords him. And so part of the hope of going to this place is to capture Jefferson in his moral complexity and in his humanity, right? Like he is a deeply flawed, imperfect, brilliant, racist person. Right. In all of the complicated ways you hold those things together. And I remember I went on a tour. They have a bunch of different tours at Monticello that you can take because Jefferson was pretty, he's a dynamic guy, had a lot of different facets to his life. But there's also a tour specifically about slavery at Monticello. And I was on this tour and it was led by a guy named David Thorson, older white guy, had a wide brown brimmed hat, khakis, an Oxford shirt, sort of professorial disposition. Mm. And it was me and about a dozen other people. And David went on to sort of discuss, as I mentioned previously, the sort of intellectual and moral inconsistencies of Jefferson's life, the cognitive dissonance of his inconsistent moral stances. Mm-hmm. And I was watching these two women, named Donna and Grace, as David was giving this presentation. And they were clearly unsettled by what they were hearing. I always remember looking at Donna, and her face was agape, her mouth was agape, her face was wilting. And I went over to them after the presentation was done. I said, it seems like you all were really affected by some of what David said. I'd love to hear your thoughts. And she turned to me and she was just like, man, he really took the shine off the guy. She was like, I had no idea Jefferson owned slaves. I had no idea Monticello was a plantation. And mind you, these are folks who bought plane tickets, rented cars, got hotel rooms, who came to the site as a sort of pilgrimage to see the home of one of our founding fathers, and yet had no idea that he was an enslaver. And for me, that was such an important moment because it was a reminder that there are millions of people across this country who still don't understand the history of slavery and the history of this country and the history of our founding in any way that's commensurate with the actual impact and legacy that is left. And so, you know, part of what this book is attempting to do is lean into the complexity of these places, the people who once lived in these places, and think about how each of us are interacting with these places and putting them in conversation with our lives and our families and our personal histories today.
And there was someone else that I may be confusing visits here a little bit, but there's some of the guys would get pushback from people who were on the tour.
Yeah.
And saying, well, you're not telling the story. I think David Thorson said something like, history is what you need to know, but nostalgia is what you want to hear.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I think any plantation that is attempting to tell a more honest story of itself has, at least in my experience and spending time with the tour guides and the docents, they receive pushback, you know, and especially at a place like Monticello, where there are people who show up who aren't necessarily cognizant of that part of Jefferson's legacy, perhaps more so now in 2023 than they would have been, you know, a few years ago, given the way that our conversation has shifted and lifted up the, again, the sort of complexity of our founding fathers in ways that hadn't previously been done. But I think, you know, I remember there was a docent I spent time with at Monticello who said that one of the reasons there's so much pushback when people talk about Jefferson and slavery is because, as I mentioned before, like Jefferson, perhaps more than any other historical figure, arguably embodies, he is the personification of America. Like when people think of America, when they think of its essence, when they think of its founding, they think of Washington. They think, you know, now because of the musical, they think of Hamilton. And they think of Jefferson, right? Like, and you know, maybe and maybe a handful of others, but he is at the center of our founding narrative, and he is thus at the center, and the mythology around him is so deeply for centuries has been so deeply entrenched into the story of American exceptionalism, into the story of us being the sort of shining light on the hill, that when somebody interrogates or complicates who Jefferson was, people take it very personally. Because if you're criticizing Jefferson, you're criticizing America. If you're criticizing America, you're criticizing me, right? Because people's identities are so deeply entangled in the story of America that they've been told their entire lives and told by people they love, people they respect. Their sense of self is entangled in a sense of patriotism that doesn't allow for critique, that doesn't allow for complexity. And I think thus, as a result, people take it personally or take it as a personal affront when somebody is criticizing a person who, whether, you know, consciously or unconsciously, they deeply associate with and they deeply who represents the America that they have been told that they live in.
And so you have a guy who, you know, wrote all men are created equal, but he literally enslaved four of his own children. It's with Sally Hemings. It is something that it's just hard to imagine, given all, you know, that I ever learned or that anybody else or most other people learned about the history of our country and the history of Jefferson. So it's just hard to come to grips with that.
Yeah, I was, as I said, I was not told that that Jefferson had children that he enslaved. I mean, I think it's, and so much of the way that I have come to make sense of a lot of this is inevitably animated by the fact that I have children of my own.
Yeah.
And I have, you know, a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. And I remember there was a moment at the Whitney Plantation, which is another plantation I visited, and this is in Louisiana, and it is an original plant, original slave cabin, like a slave cabin that was there in the 19th century and is still standing. Yeah. And I remember going in there, you know, you hear the moan, sort of the wood moan beneath your feet. As you walk across, you can see the light sort of sneak in through cracks in the roof. So you feel an intimate sense of place, an intimate sense of proximity to this history. And I think previously when I thought about slavery, I thought about it, or when I thought about the violence of slavery, I thought about it largely in terms of the spectacle of physical cruelty and physical violence that was enacted on people, people being beat, people being hung, people being thrashed. And that was a huge part of it. But that the way that I also thought about that sort of singularly in that context, because that's the way we've been presented through media, through history, about the violence that slavery was. But I never thought as much about family separation.
Yeah, that's
which was an enormous part of the violence of slavery. And there was this moment where I was standing in that slave cabin at the Whitney, and I closed my eyes and I imagined what it would be like if I went to sleep one night, put my children to bed, and then I woke up the next day and my children were gone. And I had no idea where they went. I had no idea who had taken them. I had no idea if I would ever see them again. It's like an unfathomable imaginative exercise to consider that your children would be taken from you stolen from you. And then you have this moment where you realize that, oh, this was the omnipresent threat that millions of enslaved people lived under every single day of their lives across generations, that at any moment you could be taken from your husband, your wife, your children, your parents, your brother, your sister, your cousins, your family, your community, that at any moment you could be taken away or they could be taken away for no reason at all.
Yeah.
And it is... It wasn't until I had kids of my own that the sort of emotional weight of that fully stuck. But you go to these places, you go to Monticello, you know, you go to Whitney, you go to so many of these places, and it's impossible, I think, not to imagine how devastating it would be. Beyond words, there's no language to express how horrific an experience that would be, and yet it was the experience of millions of people.
Mike in Appleton, will give you a chance to join in. Thank you for waiting.
Okay, hello. So first thing I have to say is thank you. You write so beautifully that I don't have the words to describe it. I really don't. So thank you for that. But I'm a retired educator, and I used to confront this kind of stuff with my students, and they had no idea about it. But I could only read your book in pieces because I felt so despairing as a white, you know, an old white man, thinking about this. And so, it's even hard to talk about right now. So, but my question is, how can I connect, and where do you suggest I go to have intelligent conversations, you know, because, you know, Appleton, we're 75,000 people and a big Asian population. But I have tried to connect, you know, with, you know, diversity type people. And like I said, when I was still working, boy, I was really connected. But now I'm just having a hard time because.
Yeah. Well, Clint, what do you think? How can Mike converse more, or maybe how can he approach? What approaches could he take to learn more as well? I guess.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking about a couple things. First thing is that I appreciate what he's saying, and his it sounds like his efforts to be in conversation with a more diverse group of people than perhaps he is in now in his life. One thing I'll say is that it is not necessary to have conversations about these subject matters. It is not necessary to be around different groups of people necessarily, right? Like one of the things that I think is most can be most generative is when white people are having conversations with other white people around these things, right? So it is not the case that you read, you know, my book or any other book wrestling with the complexity and totality of American history and how race pertains to that. You know, it's deeply important that there are book clubs full of white people discussing these things and thinking about what it means for them, what sort of implications that has for their lives. I think there is value in that. There is an importance in holding one another accountable in those specific sort of spaces. With that said, you know, if it's a town that doesn't have, you know, a very diverse population, obviously that is limiting in terms of how much time you spend with a different group of people. What I would say is that I think there are ways to experience different, to be in conversation with different groups of people, to experience different parts of people's culture that are thoughtful, but also demand being proactive, right? And so I'm not familiar with the area, and so I don't know what that looks like specifically. But, you know, one thing I can say that a lot of people who've read this book have done, which I've been really moved by, is that they've gotten together and taken trips to a lot of the sites that I name in the book and others, right? Like, because this book is about 8 or 9 different places, but I could have written about 100,009, right? I mean, there's endless places. You could just do a road trip around Wisconsin, right, to find places that have a relationship to this history. And there are Black History Museums and there are all sorts of, you know, civil rights museums, and, you know, whether in the state or somewhere else, where you can go and learn and be in conversation with people whose job it is to be in conversation around these things. I mean, what I don't want is for anybody to like walk up, you know, go searching for Black people to have, you know, random Black people to have these conversations with, because I don't think that that's appropriate. But there are places and people whose jobs it is to be in conversation around these things. And one of the reasons I spend so much time thinking about museums and historical sites and the like is because these are places where those sorts of conversations can happen with the people who are in those museums and spaces, but also among the group of people who are going to visit there. So all that's to say, I appreciate the intentionality behind it and the thoughtfulness. And I think I would encourage, you know, Mike, to just be, you know, think about taking a trip to some of these different, you know, sites and maybe doing some research. There are groups who organize these things. Like there are people who go on Civil War tours, civil rights tours. They go to a lot of, you know, they'll stop at different sites that have a relevant link to these different parts of history. And maybe that's an option.
Yeah, maybe it is. Jill Nadeau and I were talking at some point Both of us, of course, have read the book, and we wanted to, I said, I really want to go to New York City, and I really want to take that tour with Damaris Obi. What a remarkable person, and the what I learned from you and from, you know, what she had to say about that particular city was just absolutely mind-boggling. And
the company, I'm not sure, I don't think Damaris works there anymore, but the company Inside Out Tours in New York City is one of a few groups that do do tours around the history of slavery in New York City. And I think, you know, it's so important, but there are also groups that do that in all sorts
all
of cities.
All sorts of places.
North, you know? Yeah. And sometimes you'd be surprised how you don't have to look very far, right? All it takes is a little bit of Googling and in your own community, in your own state, in your own city, there might be, you know, a small group or an individual. Like in New Orleans, there's one guy who basically runs what's called Hidden History of New Orleans that brings people on tours to see, you know, different parts of New Orleans' relationship to the history of slavery. So, yeah, all sorts of different places have similar versions of that.
Clint Smith, our guest today, author of How the Word is Passed. We're going to take some more calls here, but just a reminder that you, my friends, are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with author Clint Smith about his remarkable book, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America, our book club selection on the Larry Mueller Show. Jesse in Fontana, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much for taking the call. Well, my God, first, Happy New Year to all. And second, so many things to this member here, but let me start with one important, very important part. Being a descendant of the first Americans to this continent, and the Americans are not the natives, they do not like the term. We, my antecessors, the Emperor of Castile, are the ones that accepted the term America. America is not the United States. America is the continent. Since 1500s. Number two, it is unfortunate that things like slavery had happened. My antecessors are the first ones that brought slaves to this continent in what is now Mexico, which part of my family is from, because Texas belonged to them. They brought more than 6 million slaves, African slaves, and they continue north and south. Unfortunately, it happened. But now, the misunderstanding of people in of history here in the United States is that Latinos are always from Mexico, and Latinos come from Latium, which is the state of Lazio today in Italy, has never stopped to exist. Number four, I've been not a victim because I can't defend myself very well, and people has tried to push the envelope of being in America, in the United States, and how do I feel about that? So, well, no, how do you feel about it? Because we invented it, not you. And I've been walking into places, and they turn around right away, looking at me like I'm going to do something. And so I have to give them the history that I just tried to resume in the last minute or so to let them know that we were here before. We invented the term America for the continent. We, unfortunately, my antecessors brought the slaves to this continent first and filled it with it all the way to Brazil, Chile, Colombia, all of it.
Clint, comment.
I think, you know, part of what I'm thinking about as it relates to that comment is that it is true, and a lot of people take for granted or don't fully appreciate that slavery was not something the African slave trade was not something unique to the United States. Over 40% of the Africans transported through the Middle Passage and the transatlantic slave trade ended up in Brazil. The United States had far fewer captured Africans that were brought here. And one of the reasons that so many captured Africans were brought to a place like Brazil is because the climate of Brazil relative to the United States were so different. And in Brazil, captured Africans only didn't live very long, right? They would work in these fields in Brazil and they would be killed and they would die within the first, you know, decade of them being there. And so it necessitated a constant replenishing of human chattel to be brought over. Whereas in the United States, people would be brought over and they would have families and they would have children. And it, you know, in 1808, the international slave trade was made illegal. And so it was people still brought, you know, illegally brought in captured Africans via ships all over the country, but not to the same extent. But slavery continued to grow in the United States because of the domestic slave trade. And because of the way that slavery was set up here, it meant that people were having families and people were, and because of what's called partus sequitur ventrum, which was started by the Virginia colony, it meant that people who were born, people took on the status of their mother. So, which is very different than what it was in England. In England, previously, it was like what the child took on the status of their father. But in the United States, people took on, they changed it so that a child took on the status of their mother, in part because so many enslavers were raping were raping African women. And the children who were born of that, they didn't want to raise as if they were white children. They wanted to ensure that that was not their problem. And so a child who was born of an enslaved woman was themselves enslaved. I think that's just an important point because, one, you know, it is true that the histories of the slave trade we don't often account for like the slaves that went to South America, which is why there are so many Black people in different countries throughout South America today. But also, you know, remembering that it was the domestic slave trade after 1808 that led to the sort of greatest proliferation of enslaved people across the United States. And one other point, you know, I'm thinking a lot about, and I say this at the very beginning of my book, you know, all of these places before they were plantations, before enslaved people were brought there, before captured Africans were here, before the British were here, you know, this was indigenous land. And I name that at the beginning of the book and say, you know, I name the land that each historical site is based on and like which, what the sort of tribal affiliation of that land and not as an empty gesture, but as a recognition that like, there's so many stories about the land that I go to that can be told, right? Like there's a version of this book that focuses on indigenous Americans and how different historical sites commemorate or honor or talk about their relationship to the history of different indigenous groups. And I would love to read that book. And there are many scholars who write important books about that history. But this book is obviously coming from a very personal space of being the descendant of enslaved people myself and thinking about how our histories are documented or not documented in so many of these sites.
Yeah. Dennis in Two Rivers has a comment, I believe. Let's go there. Dennis, hello.
Yeah, thank you, Larry. Quint, I think if I heard you correctly, you were reading about how Thomas Jefferson claimed Africans weren't able to feel emotional love, and he criticized their cognitive processes. And it just, the enslavers traumatized Africans, and they withheld education, but yet they judged Africans based on what the whites inflicted on the blacks?
Yeah, I think that's the sort of cruel insidiousness of it all. It's this idea that you would suggest that someone is intellectually incapable of engaging with certain ideas, of creating certain art, when you have made a specific and intentional and systemic effort under the omnipresent threat of violence to prevent that person from in any sort of intellectual engagement, right? I mean, and so that's the horror and the insidiousness of slavery, you know, among many, is that you would suggest that Black people don't have a certain level of cognitive capacity while at the same time preventing Black people from being able to learn how to read and write.
Yeah. Let's go to Bob in Madison. Bob, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yeah. Hi, Quint. I really enjoyed your very evocative description of aspects of an enslaved person's life earlier. I, as an undergrad, had the opportunity to study history in West Africa. And one of the courses that I took was the history of the slave trade and its impact on West Africa. And we studied the oral tradition, which I'm sure you have done as well. And we looked at stories that we could define as being from the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And what was really shocking to me was that they tell stories of social, economic, political chaos created by the slave trade. So it was interesting from an African's perspective, the horrible impact that it had there on the people.
Yeah,
and that's a part of the history that's not often considered. One of the places that I go in the book, it's the last chapter before the epilogue, is Gorée Island in Dakar, Senegal. And part of the reason I went there was because, kind of as you mentioned, like there, we don't often think about, excuse me, the impact that slavery had on in its space of origin. And I was really interested, how do people in Senegal, you know, when millions of people were taken from the Senegambia region in the 18th and 19th century, how do they think about the role that slavery played in shaping their landscape, like their human ecosystem? And I discovered that it's a deeply complex story. And, you know, when I went to Gorée, I spent time with a group of school children who were talking, you know, very thoughtfully about the relationship between a history of colonialism and a history in West Africa and a history of slavery in the United States. And they are currently wrestling with a lot of the same questions or a lot of analogous questions that we're wrestling with here. I remember walking down one of the streets in Senegal and it was named, and my translator pointed up and he was like, "That's named after one of our French colonizers." And he was like, "We're trying to do the same thing here, where we have statues of people who colonized us. We have streets named after people who stole from us. And we're sitting here like, why are those here?" In the same way that, you know, in the United States over the last several years, we've been wrestling with where to and how to take down names and statues of people who were leaders of the Confederacy or who were themselves enslavers and asking those questions. Mm-hmm. So it was fascinating to learn about the sort of parallel that's happening in different parts of Africa, where they are similarly wrestling with these questions. I think we're in a moment, you know, part of what the success of the Black Lives Matter movement that was sort of supercharged after George Floyd is that we saw a lot of these questions come up across the world, not just here in the United States. Statues came down in England. People were having protests in France. You know, there were conversations happening in South Africa, you know, so it became a real global movement that pushed people to think about how they are taught about history, both in our schools and in our sort of public landscapes, and what stories are being included and what stories are being removed.
Well, Clint, I want to tell you, I could show you that I have pages of notes about your book that we're not used today. And it's for those who are listening in today and who haven't read Clint's book, I highly encourage you to get a copy and take a look at how the word is passed. It's a riveting book, so well written, and tells a story that I am willing to bet 99.9% of the people, of those of you listening, have not heard. And I want to thank you so much, Clint, for being with us today and for writing the book. It was marvelous talking with you and marvelous reading the book. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Larry. It was great to be on.
Clint Smith, the author, and the book title is How the Word is Passed. It was great to have him with us, and I hope sometime I can have him back and we can talk again about this. It would be a real pleasure for me. Coming up, we're going to take a look at diversity on the UW-Madison campus with the Deputy Vice Chancellor for Diversity and Inclusion. And we're going to take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with our guest, Dr. LeVar Charleston. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.